Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the program, we'll discuss the conviction of 9 anti-ICE protesters in Texas and why many see the ruling as a turning point in the administration's crackdown on dissent and First Amendment rights. Could the case set a new precedent where anti-terrorism laws are used against protesters here in the United States? But first, we're going to look at Israel's military assault and invasion of Lebanon and the rapidly deepening humanitarian crisis there. Global attention has been focused on the Strait of Hormuz and the temporary ceasefire between Iran and the United States. But Israel's nearly 5-week-long assault on Lebanon has received far less attention here in the U.S. Since March 2nd, Israeli airstrikes have killed more than 1,500 people in Lebanon, including at least 130 children, with nearly 4,500 people injured. Entire communities have been uprooted, more than 1.2 million people having fled their homes. And the attacks have continued even with the ceasefire. On Wednesday, Israel carried out more than 100 strikes across the country in about 10 minutes. The vast majority of the casualties were in the capital and its southern suburbs, with over 150 killed. To get the latest and discuss the media coverage of Israel's military assault in Lebanon, we're joined live from Beirut by Leila Younis. Leila is a journalist and editor at The Public Source, which is a Beirut-based online magazine dedicated to uncompromising journalism and critical commentary from the left. Welcome, Leila.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you join us. I hope you're safe there. But before we dive in and talk about what happened on Wednesday and this ongoing conflict, I just want to ask about how you're doing in the midst of this situation, what you've had to witness in this military assault here. How are you and other journalist colleagues of yours holding up in the country?
It's a hard question. I mean, this is my first war. I'm Lebanese American. I grew up in the U.S. and moved here a year ago. So it's strange to encounter something that, you know, my mother, like the generation before us, encountered, and to kind of be here again. It's as terrifying as it is to be in a place that's getting heavily bombarded. We always think first of the people who are the most vulnerable. So that would be the residents of the South, who, you know, some remain in their villages and they're sort of hunkering down, and then some are displaced and in precarious conditions. And so, you know, those are really the people that I want to focus on. But I will say, you know, for people who haven't experienced being in a place under heavy airstrikes and bombardment, drone activity at all hours of the night, and warplanes ripping overhead, it's terrifying and something that, you know, no one should have to endure.
Well, certainly hope that you are safe, and appreciate what you're doing to bring this conflict to a wider audience here and a perspective from the ground. So can you talk about what the current situation is like in Beirut? I mean, particularly with this, you know, a pretty remarkable series of strikes on Wednesday. What was that like?
Wednesday was awful. It was a day. I mean, people are saying it's one of the worst days in Lebanese history. And this is a country that has endured successive wars with Israel, and also a brutal civil war from 1975 to 1990. Wednesday, you know, we kind of went to sleep on Tuesday night wondering whether or not Lebanon would be included in the ceasefire with Iran. And, you know, it seemed like we were included. The Iranians said that we're part of their 10-point plan, which they delivered to Trump, which had been accepted. Then we hear Netanyahu say, no, Lebanon's not in the plan. So we go to sleep. We're kind of not really sure whether or not we're in or not. The drone activity was remarkable on Tuesday night. I don't think I've ever heard it that low. It felt like there was a lawnmower over my head. I couldn't sleep. Next day, you know, everyone kind of just goes to work and is going about their business. A quarter past 2 p.m., it's just like it's like the sky open and fire was just raining down from it. You know, we heard missile after missile sizzle through the air and then crash into the earth. It was terrifying. And then I went on my balcony. I live in central Beirut, and I look out and I don't see smoke rising from one direction. I see smoke rising from all directions, like three different parts of the city, you know, very disparate parts of the city are hit. I go up on the roof and I look out and I see it, ambulance sounds, people screaming, you know, in the streets. Immediately we knew that something had changed, that this was sort of an escalation. This was the Israelis saying, no, you are not part of the ceasefire. Our war will continue on Lebanon. And it's now a different war. It's now a war on pretty much an indiscriminate war on all parts of Beirut, in which we will basically be flattening apartment buildings on the heads of their civilian residents without warning. So this was remarkable. And I'll say, I mean, everyone, so many of my friends, I should say, had close calls on Wednesday. A very close friend of mine, we were supposed to spend the day at his apartment. At the last minute, we decided to co-work at my apartment. His neighbor's home was, or apartment complex, I should say, was flattened to the ground. 27 people died in that building, including children. And I went and stood outside the rubble, you know, yesterday morning, and just, it's unbelievable to see children's toys scattered among this like broken concrete. So really a different, something that we haven't encountered before in Lebanon. Hospitals immediately were overwhelmed, supplies strained. I went and donated blood because they were urgently asking for blood donations, especially of my type, the universal type O. And, you know, the blood bank was full. It was chaotic and people, you know, crying outside the hospital. So this is the scene in Beirut. And again, you know, some, this American tax dollars are paying for these bombs, but I'm not really sure many Americans are aware of the ongoing assault on Lebanon.
Well, it just sounds absolutely harrowing, and just glad that you are safe, as I said, and really important to have your eyewitness accounts of what you're seeing here. I'm glad we can share this with our listeners. You talked about the ceasefire and this idea that this was supposed to encompass Lebanon as well. What is the latest on that now? It seems like the U.S. is trying to get Israel to abide by the ceasefire terms, as far as we could tell from some of the reporting, perhaps from the vice president's comments. What is your understanding of how the ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran applies now to Lebanon?
You know, it's very unclear for several reasons. You know, first Trump said, we agree to the ceasefire. Then, you know, apparently Netanyahu and him have a call. Then he says Lebanon is actually not part of the ceasefire. The Iranians then accuse Trump of dishonesty. They say, we're not starting these negotiations out on the right foot. They declare that they will now be closing the Strait of Hormuz again in solidarity with Lebanon. They threaten that strikes will resume if the Israelis don't, you know, stop their assault. And then, you know, the other thing to mention here, and this is, you know, opening a bit of a can of worms, but the Lebanese government has been in this push and pull with Hezbollah for 15 months now, right? Since Hezbollah opened up a solidarity front with Gaza after October 7, 2023, firing rockets at Israeli military infrastructure. Now, Hezbollah is a significant part of the Lebanese government, but they also have a military wing that operates mostly in the south. And so that military wing operates independently of the state. And that's something that's created great division in Lebanon, really for, you know, almost two decades now. And so the Lebanese government has, certain parts of the Lebanese government have actually been quite antagonistic to the Iranians and have not, you know, maybe even appreciated Iran, including, you know, or saying that it's going to negotiate on behalf of Lebanon. The Lebanese government has said, no, we will negotiate on behalf of ourselves. And they've sort of buckled down and said, this is an issue of our personal sovereignty. They've even said that they will, and this is historic because Israel is considered an enemy state to Lebanon. They've said that they will open direct negotiations with the Israelis, something that we've never seen before, with the U.S. as their guarantor in these negotiations. So it's on a diplomatic level, you know, it's very confusing. And, you know, of course, it's the civilians that are sort of left holding the bag. They are, you know, at the mercy of these powers that are so much bigger than them. And this kind of geopolitical chessboard that's shifting in a very confusing way. And we have no idea, right, where the country's going.
Yes. Well, we're speaking with Leila Younes, journalist and editor at The Public Source, a Beirut-based online magazine. She's speaking to us from Lebanon. Previously, she had worked for Grist and ProPublica. This is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Do want to open up the phone lines if anyone has questions about what's happening in Lebanon right now, any personal connections to Lebanon that they want to talk about. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at yourcall@klw.org. Well, Leila, you just described this complicated situation in Lebanon with Hezbollah firing rockets into Israel from the south, not necessarily under the control of the Lebanese government. What is the objective, as far as you could tell, of the Israelis here? What are they trying to accomplish in launching this military assault?
I think it's important to remember the history here. You know, this isn't coming out of the blue. Lebanon and Israel have been in and out of wars for really, 75 years, I suppose you could say, right? Israel was an aggressor in the Lebanese Civil War. Even, you know, in 1948, at the establishment of the State of Israel, several Lebanese villages were sort of absorbed into that land and ethnically cleansed. Then after the Civil War, there was a 18-year occupation of southern Lebanon by the Israelis. And then it was resistance groups with a fledgling Hezbollah actually at the helm that expelled that occupation. Then, of course, after 2000, that's sort of when the land is liberated. It returns to Lebanon. Then 2006 arrives and Hezbollah kidnaps a couple Israeli soldiers at the border after months of rising tensions and a massive military assault on Lebanon after 2006 from the Israelis, in which many parts of the south are flattened under bombs and the southern suburbs. So, you know, I think it's important for listeners to remember this is an area that's experienced really seasons of war. It's not, you know, that border, that southern border is a very tense one. And I think, you know, if you ask southern Lebanese people, they're going to point to the statements of Israeli politicians that, you know, recent ones and older ones that have said, you know, the land of southern Lebanon is ours. You know, we want to build settlements there and so on. Other Lebanese will tell you, you know, or that this is quite a big debate in Lebanon. Like they might say, that Hezbollah maintains quite a significant military presence along this border, which is not something that, you know, the Israeli state feels that it can tolerate having a military presence along that border. And I think it's also important for listeners to remember, you know, the Lebanese military, you know, Lebanon's a very poor state. The Lebanese army is a very underfunded army, actually funded by the United States, and historically unable to protect the south from Israeli aggression, which is why that's where groups like Hezbollah, you know, derive their legitimacy from, that kind of history of an aggressor nation, you know, next door, and from an army that can't protect that region. And so, you know, therefore a resistance group that can, with, of course, the funding and support of Iran. So that's the status in Lebanon. It's very complicated. It's you know, a divided a population, kind of, you know, one maybe part of the population will tell you, well, you know, we don't necessarily want to normalize with Israel, but, you know, we're tired of these wars. We don't want war anymore. And people of the south will tell you, yeah, well, we don't want war either. But, you know, we're concerned that this that the Israelis, you know, want to take our land, our resources, want to resume an occupation as they sort of are announcing they want to. So this is kind of the rhetoric that we're hearing over here.
Well, Leila Younes, such a really amazing summary of such a complicated history and just situation on the ground. I really appreciate you kind of summarizing that for our listeners. And just to follow up in terms of what Israel is trying to accomplish at this point, we know Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, has said that the IDF is deploying its, quote, model from Gaza in Lebanon. Is the aim here some sort of collective punishment of people in southern Lebanon for allowing Hezbollah to fire rockets into Israel from this portion of Lebanon? Or is this an effort, as you just hinted at, is potentially occupying, taking over land in southern Lebanon? What do you think is their end game at this point?
Yeah, absolutely think there is an element of collective punishment here, not only against the people of the South, but very particularly against the Shiite community, right? Hezbollah is a Shiite a group. Lebanon is a country that's government is divided by law along sectarian lines. So, you know, these Shia and the South is majority Shia. So these Shia villages that Hezbollah has operated out of historically are the ones that are getting flattened now. And when I say flattened, I mean, it's really hard, Ethan, to describe what it's like. I mean, I spent a lot of time going to the border and reporting over the past year. I mean, these villages, and I'm, you know, my family's from one of them. They don't just, you know, bomb a house or two. A village like Ait Shaib or Khiem, Meis Jabal. These villages are flattened. You know, just vast destroyed earth. And people kind of, even some of them living amid some of these ruins. And so, you know, this, there already was a immense destruction last war. And I think now the goal is to kind of enter to do a scorched earth campaign, because that would basically disallow the Hezbollah to basically be able to operate out of, you know, urban infrastructure, right? So they're going in, they're booby trapping houses. Some villages like Deir Sirian, they kind of brag, just as against international law. I think it's important to note, right? Just vast destruction of civilian property. They booby trapped the village of Deir Sirian and published a video of them just exploding the entire village in one fell swoop, you know? And so it's clear that they want to, they're saying, and they're doing, this is what they're doing. They're destroying this earth. They're also bombing it with white phosphorus, internationally restricted, very toxic chemical. And they want to go in and they want to take what they're saying is a buffer zone. And they first said 16 kilometer buffer zone, and then they walked it back to 8. It's not clear what their kind of goal is now. But this buffer zone, I think it's important to note, you know, 8 kilometers into southern Lebanon, and it's dozens and dozens of villages, right? This is where thousands of people live. That would, you know, include my family's village that would go, it would, you know, be absorbed into the Israeli state. So, you know, when we're talking about a quote unquote buffer zone, I mean, this is an ethnic cleansing, right? This is people's land, their lives, their homes. So that's what they're saying they want to do. Whether or not they'll be able to do it is a different question. I mean, again, like, you know, obviously they're a more powerful military, but the Hezbollah as a, you know, resistance group has proven to be able to perform well on the ground, you know, over the course of its history. So whether or not they'll be able to hold that land is a different question entirely.
Well, and the devastation in the South just sounds really pretty overwhelming. There's a quote here from a Lebanese journalist who writes, "The South is gone. The house is actually the sister of a journalist. The South is gone. The house is gone. Olive groves are gone. Life is gone." This is a sister, Maha Salma, of a Lebanese journalist, told the Arab news here. Survivors describe running through the streets as missiles struck one after another. "We saw death with our own eyes," one woman told another newspaper after fleeing a strike that hit near her home. How widespread is this devastation in southern Lebanon? How are people coping down there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I would say in the Shiite villages, it's quite widespread. Wow, switch to Arabic for a second. Now, some of the villages are more destroyed than others. The border strip is almost completely, really immense destruction along that border strip. You get a little deeper into southern Lebanon and there's destruction, but it's not as you know, widespread, I would say. And now, of course, there's also the Christian villages in the South, and there's also Druze and Sunni villages in the South, right? So that's important to note. So, you know, I did one of my last stories for Dropside News, which is another publication that I work for. I was interviewing residents of the village of Debel and Rmesh on the southern border. These are two Christian villages. And, you know, it's really devastating. Those people, there's thousands of people who've kind of chosen to remain on their land. They say, "We will not leave our earth. We will not see our homes destroyed. This is sacred earth." They had some guarantees from the Americans. And I mean, this should really show you that the sectarianism that's kind of being fueled by the Israeli, you know, American alliance here. But they got guarantees that those civilian homes would not be destroyed. However, you know, the Lebanese army, after getting, as you said in your introduction, fired on quite a lot by the Israelis, they retreated, leaving those villages to their fate, essentially. And so those villages have basically been cut off from each other and the world. They're essentially besieged. There's fighting around them. I heard a horrifying story of a father and son who were just going, you know, to the village next door and just coming back. It was a 5-minute drive. They were ambushed on their way back, basically killed. And then no one was even able to go rescue them. They had to, basically, they called for the Red Cross. They called for the United Nations peacekeepers. No one could get the okay to go, you know, rescue this father and son. And so the people themselves actually got some white mattresses and blankets and held them up and went, you know, fearing for their own lives to pull this dead father and son out of the car and bury them, right? These are the stories we're hearing from the Christian villages in southern Lebanon, right? In the Sunni highlands in the southeast, there have been abductions, raids in the middle of the night. Again, you know, no army there anymore to protect these people. So they kind of have been putting together their own little forces of night watchers and so on, but they don't have the ability to stand up against an Israeli military.
When we're speaking with Leila Younes, a journalist and editor at The Public Source, a Beirut-based online magazine. She's calling in live from Lebanon. We're talking about the situation in Lebanon here on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Phone lines are open if you want to have any, if you have any questions for Leila about what's happening on the ground. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email here from Carol in Oakland who writes, "My paternal grandparents were from Lebanon. While I've never visited and only have distant relatives whom I do not know, I've always felt a deep connection to the country, and I've been so distraught over what is occurring there, not just this week, but also for year after year of assaults by Israel. What can people like me do to help? And thank you for letting us know what is happening there." Any thoughts for Carol?
Oh, thank you for your message, Carol. You know, and I hope that you can come visit someday. The other thing that I'd love to tell everyone about Lebanon, it's an absolutely beautiful place. And I moved here for that reason. The mountains, the ocean, it's one long, gorgeous coastline. And, you know, it's a place to visit, you know, when things stabilize. I think what Americans can do really is obviously put pressure on their local officials and their government to stop U.S. military aid to Israel, really, because that is kind of what is fueling these forever wars. And, you know, I think also, you know, obviously all types of civil protests and so on can go a long way. And I would encourage that type of civic behavior. I would also say, you know, really the most pressing thing of all would be to donate. And there are some different, you know, the Lebanese Red Cross is always accepting donations. There are different groups as well. I mean, I obviously can't share links, I'm on the radio, but, you know, that there are many different ways to donate. And that money is desperately needed right now, I think, especially in light of the soaring gas prices because of the Strait of Hormuz closing. That's actually really, really exacerbating. It's putting a lot of pressure on aid efforts here in Lebanon and for the 1.2 million displaced. So that's a really great place to start.
Yeah. Now on the refugees, now it sounds like there's a very large number of people who have been displaced. What is the latest there?
It's a very difficult situation. I mean, because you know, Israeli military began targeting displaced people pretty early in the war, including, you know, one of the big first examples was at a tent encampment. Some displaced people had left their homes, fled, and they had pitched a tent on the beach at Ramlat al-Bayda, which is a beach on the southern boardwalk of Beirut. Drones fired on them at midnight one night, and there was a massacre there and a couple other places as well. After those displaced people were targeted, civilians, I should add, it's other parts of the country have been nervous to accept displaced Shia, basically. So, you know, that's a very difficult situation because Lebanon is a small country. Its urban areas are densely populated. There aren't a lot of places for people to go. The government has opened shelters. Mostly they're in schools, converted into shelters. They're overcrowded. They lack basic supplies and necessities. They lack showers even. So, you know, people are sort of making do with the bathrooms that exist in those schools. And then, you know, a lot of people, there's been civil strife, you know, people kind of going to other communities that are supposedly safer and being turned away or, you know, being asked for like intense background checks and all these things. And, you know, I mean, it's also understandable to a certain degree, right? Because of the targeting of displaced civilians, right? Like the fear of the other, it's something that's kind of being fueled right now by the Israeli military. And so there's just immense fear. And I think displaced people that, yeah, they have it the hardest because they're not home. And if this war taught me one thing, I mean, it's very hard to leave home. And a lot of people, because of the humiliation that they endured trying to find housing in other parts of Lebanon, went back to the South and said, we'll die at home. And many of them did die at home. And that's one thing that I spoke with a member of the Red Cross about on the phone. He's based in Sweden, the Red Cross station there. And he told me this war is harder than the last war in 2024 because there's actually more people in the villages. They went and they came back because they were experienced humiliation and horrible conditions. And so they came back and so we have more people to account for. We have more people that we have to rescue, basically, because the South is actually more populated.
It's such a humanitarian crisis with this displacement. Just have a few minutes left, but I do have a caller I want to try to fit in here. We have Kevin calling in from San Francisco. Kevin, welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable. Do we have Kevin? All right, not sure we have Kevin. I did want to ask you, Lila, I'm sorry about that, Kevin, if we couldn't connect you. I did want to ask you just about the state of media coverage of what's going on now. What's your take on how the media is covering this issue and the state of independent journalism in Lebanon specifically?
Lebanon's always been a place full of journalists. I mean, it's kind of been thought of as the lungs of the Middle East in a way. I mean, there is generally a pre-expression here. And so, you know, there's always been a hub for journalists and there's no shortage of foreign reporters here and domestic ones covering being on the ground. Of course, Israel has targeted journalists in recent weeks. Ali Shaib, Muhammad and Fatma Ftune were killed in Jazin just 2 weeks ago. I would say outside of Lebanon, however, you know, it's concerning to see the lack of coverage, right? I mean, Iran is getting a lot of coverage. We're a smaller nation. You know, we are not a regional power. We are a tiny Mediterranean country kind of at the whims of powers much greater than us. And so, you know, it's unsurprising, but very concerning that Lebanon hasn't received a lot of coverage in the press outside of here. And, you know, I hope that changes, you know, because really the fate of this country hangs in the balance of all of this. And I mean, as people will tell you in the streets, wherever you go in this country right now, we don't know where we're going. We don't know what's in store for us. We don't know how long this war will last. We don't know how many more crises will befall our people. And so I think it's very important that journalists put their eyes on Lebanon, where the bombs continue to fall.
Yes. Well, I think we have Kevin back on the line. Kevin, are you there?
Yes. Hi. I'm 66 years old and the grandson of a Holocaust survivor from Dachau. And unlike Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, I do not stand with Israel. I'm not anti-Jewish for sure, but I'm anti-Israel. And I'll tell you why. Israel has violated 31 UN Security Council resolutions and over 100 General Assembly resolutions. They violated the last ceasefire in Gaza 962 times. They killed 700 people since the so-called October ceasefire. They violated the Lebanese ceasefire over 4,500 times. It's a rogue regime trying to create a greater Israel with ethnic cleansing, genocide, annihilation, extermination, and we've given them $300 billion. And I'm disgusted that we had this.
Yeah. No, thank you, Kevin, for sharing that. I think a lot of people share those feelings. We're just about out of time. I just want to ask you, I guess, following up on that, given what we just heard from Kevin, the dynamics that you're witnessing firsthand on the ground in Lebanon, just very briefly as we're closing here, what do you see as happening next now in this conflict? Where does this leave us?
I wish I could tell you. You know, I think a lot hinges on Iran. You know, if Iran really doubles down and says Lebanon is part of these ceasefire talks, we could either see the U.S., you know, relent to that in some form and force Israel's hand towards a ceasefire in Lebanon, or we could see, this is what we fear, a reopening of the war on a massive scale, horrific destruction in both Iran and Lebanon. Yeah. It's unclear. It's unclear which of those two options will land on.
We greatly appreciate your reporting. We hope you stay safe. Lila Yunus, journalist and editor at The Public Source, calling in from Lebanon. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about a jury verdict against anti-ICE protesters in Texas that could have a major chilling effect on First Amendment rights and protest in this country going forward. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this break.